This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, January 16th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. Last week, we at the Cato Institute were saddened to learn of the passing of our colleague, the journalist Nat Hentoff. I spoke with Scott Bullock, president of the Institute for Justice, about Hentoff's powerful legacy and his twin loves of jazz and the Constitution.
You knew Nat Hentoff in a way that a lot of us here at Cato know Nat Hentoff, which is mostly by phone. And I would occasionally have phone calls with him, and we would talk about music. We would talk about the things that he was writing. We would talk about all sorts of things. And he always had some incredible story to go along with almost anything you could possibly mention. In particular, I remember I had a conversation. I said, "Yeah, I like jazz a lot, but I'm more of a bluegrass guy. I play the banjo a little bit." And he goes, "Well, let me tell you, in the 1950s, I went on tour with Flatt and Scruggs." And I was just I was absolutely in heaven hearing this story about this little fuzzy-headed guy with a pipe traveling throughout the South with Flatt and Scruggs. But that was fairly typical. He was well acquainted with all manner of musical figures and wrote extensively about them.
Yeah, it was amazing, the amount of people that he knew, the experiences that he had in the music world, even leaving aside all the great writings he did about the Constitution. And it was primarily jazz, but you're right. I mean, he was one of the early writers about Bob Dylan. And
he wrote the liner notes to the Freewheeling Bob Dylan.
That's right. And had a sense of experience in country music as well, wonderful profiles of Merle Haggard. But his experience with the jazz musicians is really legendary as well. I mean, he truly knew all of the great jazz musicians, and not just knew them in the sense that he interviewed them, but really got to know them as people. And one of the great things he did in his writings about jazz, too, is really portrayed them as essentially heroic individuals, too. I mean, one of my favorite books about jazz is the book that he wrote called Jazz Is. And it was just this wonderful collection of essays that portrayed jazz musicians, I said, almost in this Homeric type of light to talk about what they were able to accomplish, the struggles that they had, what they've overcome. And it's really a special book. And it's still, I think, one of the best introductory books to jazz that there is.
I remember you and I went to a club, HR 57, which is a jazz club that is in D.C. And in between sets by the live musician, they would play these old television programs of jazz musicians. And we turn and we look at it, and they have a live audience there. And there's Nat Hentoff with his pipe. And this is black and white, presumably produced in the late 50s, snapping his fingers
there
and
he
just
is.
Bopping along.
Looking his hip, as you can imagine.
And he got a lot of that on the air.
He got a lot of it on the air. He was the producer of it. And one of his proudest accomplishments, and this is noted in a lot of the obituaries about him, was this show that he did called The Sound of Jazz, where he produced it. And it was this really legendary performance of Billie Holiday when she was kind of later on in life and certainly in decline, but still had some real power behind her singing. And she was there with her great partner from years ago, Lester Young, too, who was even though he was relatively young, was still in the twilight of his years. And they had a moment there where they were playing together. She was singing, and then he came in on tenor, and it's just this magical moment that Nat always said was one of his proudest accomplishments. And it's only right, too, and it made me really smile when I read that that he died listening to the woman that he always loved, Billie Holiday.
Yeah. So Cato did not become affiliated with him until, I believe, 2008. And not to jump over the rest of his career, but he had spent decades as one of the foremost, and in my experience talking with him for videos that we produce for the Cato Institute, one of the most consistent advocates of a very broad understanding of the First Amendment.
Yes, that's right. He was in many ways a First Amendment absolutist, and he was somebody who took the Constitution, in particular the First Amendment, and also civil liberties in general, very seriously and applied it consistently as well, and was willing to speak out against violations of civil liberties no matter which party it was, and didn't have any of this sort of team spirit that you see so predominant in this town. So he was incredibly critical of George Bush's violations of the Constitution, and he was equally vociferous in his condemnations of Barack Obama's violations of the Constitution. It's probably one of the reasons why he was so appealing to Cato and agreed to set up shop here in his later years.
Now, I'm looking at his commentary section. A lot of these columns in his later years he wrote with his son, Nick. And just a few of these headlines here: Obama's epic failure to curb gun violence, free speech and loathing on the campaign trail, how Obama abandoned the American ethos of justice, Comey's Clinton probe is deja vu all over again, the elusive Trump pivot on torture, ACLU fights Dems' dishonest war on due process. This is somebody who, you know, I guess could have been construed in his early years as a liberal in the 60s sense, but not so much anymore.
No, was a true civil libertarian. I mean, his passions really were constitutional rights like the Fourth Amendment and especially the First Amendment. Those were probably the two amendments that he knew the most about, were most passionate about, and consistently adhered to a very, I think, proper but also very robust understanding of the protections afforded Americans by those two essential amendments.
When I went to New York to sit with Nat and chat with him in his apartment in 2011, we talked about free speech. We talked about anonymous speech. And I asked him, without much context, I said, well, what is the value of anonymous speech in America? And he jumped immediately to the Clarence Thomas concurrence in the Citizens United case. And I just thought to myself, wow, what a deep pull to jump in there, because of course that particular concurrence talks a lot about that idea of disclosure and whether or not organizations should be compelled to make public certain activities that they're engaged in. And to be that well read in a way that on these kinds of issues was impressive. And he was at the time, I believe, 86 or 87 years old.
Yeah, he seemed to stay on top of it throughout his life. And by the way, that was a killer Nat Hentoff impression that that you gave a little while ago from my talkings to him on the phone. It sounded exactly like him. But yeah, he would go to something like that and then also recognize, too, the very real harms that could happen to folks when the government exposes people who would like to remain anonymous in what they're saying about the government or in topics of the day. You know, one of the things that I in reading about him too, and I remember one of the things that he had said too that was really interesting in interviewing folks as well. And this is something you might want to keep in mind, Caleb, in all your interviews as well, is one of the reasons why he liked to talk to people on the phone is because he felt like people were more open. Especially entertainers or people that, you know, that always felt like they had to be on. They were giving a performance if they were
in person
with somebody. But if they were on the phone, you could get them in these more unguarded moments. And he did that. I think it's one of the reasons why he got so many of these great quotes from people from all the years. Not only was his because they trusted him, but also because he was able to talk to them directly and maybe get them to say something in a moment when they weren't on.
Of course, Nat Hentoff wrote for the Village Voice for 50-plus years, and when he was let go, you know, his opinions over the years sort of evolved in a way that I want to say he didn't really concern himself with traditional allies that he might be offending by holding a heterodox opinion. And that seemed to be a pretty consistent trait that he had.
I think that's right. And he really seemed to almost delight in the fact that he felt like he was being consistent. And he really did that with regards to free speech, too, where he felt like former allies that should be on the proper side on the right side of free speech, when they would fall away, he would really excoriate them because he felt like you guys should know better. So, you know, when various people who were more traditional civil libertarians started making exceptions for things like campus speech codes and saying, well, you know, we have to protect the sensitivities of certain people and that sort of thing, he was incredibly upset about that. And it was part of the book that he wrote, Free Speech for Me But Not for Thee. And so, you know, he did not mind having certain heterodox opinions too. One of the things where he was very outspoken about that got him a lot of grief on the left was he was very pro-life. But he saw this as sort of being consistent in a humanist sort of way. So he was anti-abortion or pro-life, as he called it, but he was also very opposed to the death penalty as well. And so he would like to also poke at conservatives too for saying, listen, you know, you say you're pro-life, but why are you so willing to condemn people to death for this? You ought to have a consistent pro-life position. So, you know, and he loved to take that and run with it, even if it offended people on either side of the political spectrum.
I'm quoting here from the NYU Journalism Institute, the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. In March 2012, the faculty at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University, together with an honorary committee of alumni, selected the 100 outstanding journalists in the United States in the last 100 years. And Nat Hentoff, of course, made that list as well for his work in such a wide variety of areas.
Very well deserved.
So there was a film that was produced just a couple of years ago. It's unfortunate that a lot of the obits leave out his Cato Institute affiliation, which, of course, we here are very proud to talk about having Nat Hentoff as a colleague. The Pleasures of Being Out of Step, that goes into a lot of his associations with a lot of jazz musicians and his advocacy in a lot of public policy areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very fitting description of who he was and what he represented for so many people. And I think one of the things that people always – he always commanded was respect. I think he got that from musicians, who were not always the easiest people to deal with, but they knew that he got this music, and he was, you know, really, really their champion, while still, you know, also knowing that he was going to give a fair and critical treatment of what they thought, and then obviously he was going to take on anybody that he felt was not consistently applying the Constitution.
Some people might be wondering, why are you talking to the president of the Institute for Justice about Nat Hentoff? And you quote Nat Hentoff. You're a great fan of jazz, and you have this quote from Nat.
Well, he said one time something I could always relate to. He said, "The Constitution and jazz are my main reasons for being." And I always related to that quote. The Constitution and jazz are certainly very strong twin passions of mine as well. So in addition to admiring Nat's writings and his views on the Constitution, I also kind of shared his approach to life too, and really, you know, being surrounded by your family and going out listening to Billie Holiday, that's not a bad way to go.
Scott Bullock is president of the Institute for Justice. You can read more of the recent work of Nat Hentoff at our website, cato.org.